Hello, welcome to A Quiet Life. I'm Ruth, your host, and I'm so glad you pressed play today. And thank you for downloading and having a listen. This podcast episode today is one of my special summer series. I thought that at this point in the year, as we're heading into a new year and we're all wondering what the year will hold, I would share some stories about how some of my friends got to the jobs they got to. And their stories are full of twists and turns and interesting things that God has done. They're all from interviews I did in the early days of A Quiet Life. And if you want to hear more from these wonderful people, you can search on ruthamos.com.au for their name and their interview should show up. There's heaps of wonderful interviews on the website, and not just these people. I had quite a time picking which ones I was going to share with you today, but we will start with Catherine. She's an actor. She's a voice actor from the USA and an actor, both. And so I started by asking her what a voice actor was.
So being a voiceover talent uses all of the acting skills because you're still telling a story with your voice. But depending on the genre, you might use more of your craft. Voiceover is literally voicing over anything where there's not a mouth moving. So it might be the actual character with his narration, you know, going on. But it could be a commercial where you don't see it on television, on radio, the phone system where you call, I don't know, the airport, you know, press one for reservations, press two. E-learning and online learning is huge now. So there's so many genres. Most people know commercial or animation, but you know, we've all also gone to a museum and had the little earphones that's narrating our way through the museum tour. So all of that, it's a big wide world.
Can I ask special favor? Can you do your Valley Girl impression for people?
Okay, I totally can. But it totally depends on what you want me to say.
It's just fantastic.
Yeah.
So did you always, you always wanted to be an actor? It was always on your mind?
No, my mom put me into drama class when I was in seventh grade because I was so shy. She honestly thought I was never going to be able to speak in front of people. And so my first play in middle school, I was the narrator, which now I look back and go, starting the voiceover work early. But I began to do more in high school and majored in it at San Francisco State. At which point my parents freaked out. No, we didn't mean for you to like be an actor full time. Don't you know 98% of all actors are unemployed? But they were public school teachers. I said, did you do that for the money? No. So it's what I love. And I've been so enormously blessed to have done it since I've been in the arts, employed in the arts since graduating undergrad so many years ago.
That's got to be a miracle, really, doesn't it?
Honestly, it does. And it's been a variety of things. I'm an organized, creative split brain. So I've worked in the box office selling tickets for events, but it's still in the arts. You know, I've coached, I've taught classes, I managed a performing arts studio. And then, of course, the narrating audiobooks or performing in plays. It's all a mishmash.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much variety there. If you, you've got to look for it, don't you? You can't get your focused on, I'm going to only be in movies or whatever. You've got to
see the doors that fling open in front of you, and sometimes stop banging so hard on the door that won't open.
So, I mean, you could always only act in Christian productions, but it doesn't sound like you've done that. So, how do you show your faith as an actor?
Well, Madeleine L'Engle has an amazing quote in her book, Walking on Water, which I highly suggest for anybody involved in the arts who is a person of faith. And she says, there is nothing so secular that it cannot be sacred. That is the message of the incarnation. And that's what I look at. It's like I get to literally become an incarnation of these characters, take a character that's on the page and make it flesh and live it out. And in that moment, I bring humanity to it. And yeah, like now I'm playing the warden in Holes, and she's the evil villain. But if we didn't have bad, we wouldn't see the light of good. So sometimes I have to be the foil, and I have to see what makes them what other people would call bad. I can't view my own character as bad, but I can see where she's hurt. I can see, you know, things that didn't end up the way she expected. And so now she takes it out on others. And then I make a more well-rounded character.
Yeah.
But especially in U.S. politics, which are quite divided right now, the entire country is divided. It became so clear to me last spring while I was doing a play that for 2 hours, people were sitting in one room together, listening to different points of view, not screaming at each other, but simply seeing people walk out their, you know, life choices. And then, it developed conversation. It increases empathy, which is missing in us a lot of places. So I find I couldn't do this job without faith, just knowing that God has a plan for me because it's such a crazy freelance career. We've been reading to kids. So just a couple hours ago, I was at church doing an after-school reading program, and I'm reading The Tale of Despero, which is the little mouse story. And in today's chapter, he's down in the dungeon, and this jailer says to him, you know, tell me a story, because stories are light. And that's what I need in this dark place. And the story ends up saving his life. And I think that's what I do.
Well, there you go. The power of the arts. It's awesome, isn't it? Catherine went on to discuss that Jesus taught in parables. The arts and storytelling are just really important parts of everyone's life. And as I said, if you want to hear more of what Catherine said, go to ruthamos.com.au and search for Catherine. She's Catherine with a C, CATHERINE. Next, I thought I'd share some of the interview I had with my dad. His name's John Langloy, and he has done many things in his life. You'll hear that he started work as a telecommunications technician, and then he joined a faith community, and after that he worked as an administrator of Clarendon Children's Home, a radio station president, the head of a Youth with a Mission base, a spiritual director at the Christian Performing Arts Fellowship, and an Anglican minister. But if you'd asked his social studies teacher in high school, he would probably have predicted that Dad wouldn't amount to much at all.
When I listed all the things that you've done in your life, I think people might be quite surprised to hear about just how awful your schooling was. So I thought maybe we could talk a bit about that, because people expect, I know that in the United States, when you're working there, people expected you to have a doctorate. People expect a certain level of schooling. So would you like to talk about that?
No.
I pass all these questions by Dad before we start.
For me, I tell people I'm someone who's educated despite the schooling, not because of it. I think I was, in some ways, a fairly typical lad. As I said, acutely self-conscious. But also someone whose focus was outdoors, building things, experimenting with things, adventures. So I was never confident enough to wag school in body, but I wagged often in spirit. So I would sit there gazing out the window, imagining all sorts of adventures while school passed me by. I remember my parents complaining about my sock studs teacher, social studies teacher, because he would, at the beginning of the week, give us a foolscap, Ronio'd page of material. And a Ronio machine, the old Gestetner machine, some people may remember, it was a methylated ink type goo that was squeezed out through a wax paper onto very furry absorbent paper. So the print was actually very fuzzy. It was close typed and close lined, and the teacher would hand us that at the beginning of the week and say, read this and you'll get a test at the end of the week. That was really it. I enjoyed science. Science, we had a young teacher who was very debonair and quite adventurous, and science, you know, you can do something and see the results, and that excited me. So that was great. And those were the days when there are all sorts of chemicals available which are no longer available. And I remember another young lad in our class decided he might put together a little banger to stick under the teacher's chair. So he mixed up some sodium and phosphorus and a few other things and shook the beaker that contained those things, at which point it exploded. And he lost his hand, and a number of the kids had glass in their kidneys. So that was quite an adventure. And from that point, a lot of those chemicals are no longer available in high schools. So I've always had an interest in things scientific. And I remember my English teacher saying that I had creative ability. One of my English teachers used to read poetry to us and other things, and I quite enjoyed that. But in those days, if you had more than 10 spelling mistakes in any written piece of work, then you automatically failed. And as I can't spell, I failed everything written anyway. So it wasn't actually encouraging. It's interesting because our son Anthony is an associate professor at Flinders, and his spelling is worse than mine, but he has the advantage of growing up in the era of spell checks. Anyway, education has advanced to some degree since I was at school. So, basically I failed high school, but I did sit an aptitude test for what was then the PMG, which then devolved into telecom and postal, and I came about equal 12th out of 400 kids. So I went into the PMG training school and got proficiency payment for excellent work, but that's because it was all practical, hands-on, and no spelling mistakes. Well, you weren't penalised for spelling mistakes. I'm sure there were plenty. So that was fun.
So I remember when you were studying later in Hawaii, the Lord sort of gave you healing from that time.
That's right.
So in between your school days and YWAM, you were the administrator of a children's home. So why did you take that on?
Well, before that, we were part of Beth Shalom Community in the very early days of that organisation. And that was set up by a dear friend of ours who was a minister who was working with alcoholics and drug addicts and people who needed a friend. And we ended up believing that God was calling us into that full-time ministry. So I tell my friends that in telecom that I decided that I was going to work for God, not the guy who thought he was God. And that was quite a leap of faith for us at that stage. It was a huge decision to make. We talked and prayed and cried a lot about that decision before we made it. But that was the pivotal one from going from a secure government position, which was comfortably paid and having a mortgage on a house, to selling a house and building on the property at Beth Shalom moving into a period where we had no guaranteed income at all. We were, as they say, living by faith. I mean, my brother, who's had his own business, says he lives by faith because he needs faith in the Lord to know what contracts to accept and not accept. So this is not saying it's any better than any other calling that God gives, but for us it was very radically different from having a secure government position. And I think we were at a point where God was speaking change to us, which we weren't expecting. And I remember at Beth Shalom, because we had 205 acres, and at that stage 500 sheep and a dozen cattle and 20 acres of barley, and we were very short-staffed. So as well as working with people who were needy and living with us, I also had responsibility for the farm. And I remember our sheep getting lice and the trauma of having to round them up and dig a sheep dip and build a shearing shed because we could no longer take them off the property to be processed, saying to God, I thought you called me here to work with people, and all I do is chase these stupid sheep. And then the Lord took us to, or took me to, the first Intercessors for Australia camp, which was actually held at a YWAM base and run by Noel Bell. And in that 3 weeks, which was quite significant on a whole lot of levels, spiritually, not just for myself, but for quite a few people who were there, it's amazing to see the names of people who were at that camp in various positions of Christian leadership around the nation since then. But someone gave me a scripture there, which was Nathan saying to David, I've taken you from being a follower of my sheep to being a leader of my people. I remember Joy Dawson challenging us. She said, because a lot of the focus of that was learning to hear the voice of God. And she said, I know a lot of you, this is on Wednesday, I know a lot of you expecting to go home on Friday, but I want to challenge you to see God as to whether you go home or whether you come with me to Japan for a 1 month outreach on Saturday.
Wow.
And she said, I want you to go away and pray, and no answer is no answer. You've got to press into God to get an answer. Well, that scripture was one of the things the Lord gave me. I called Rosalind and said, has the Lord said anything to you about Japan? Which he hadn't. But I came back, and when I came back, the community was going into retreat at Beth Shalom to see the way forward. And the Lord had brought us to a place where we had to choose a leader from among us. And Robert Legg from the parish here at Kingston called and said, I've just got something that I need to talk to you about. And I said, well, what is it, Robert? And he said, this is a bit awkward, but he said, I can't sleep until I've asked you this question. And when I've asked you the question, you can ignore it, but then I'll be able to sleep. And the question was, had I considered the position of director of Clarendon Children's Homes? And I said, no, that has not even occurred to me. The next day, another friend rang and she said, oh, I've been praying for you and I believe the Lord's telling me to say something to you, but I'm not sure, I don't want to give a false lead, so can you pray that I hear the Lord correctly before I tell you what I believe he's saying to me? So we did, and then she rang back the next day and she said, I believe the Lord's saying you're to leave Beth Shalom and move to a place closer to town. And the thought that immediately came to Rosalyn and myself was, is this putting legs on the other scripture that I've been given in Robert's phone call? And then through that whole week, we had a number of scriptures and directives as we waited in prayer with the community. At the end of that time, I went to see the bishop and I said, I believe the Lord might be calling me to this position. When do applications close? And he said, well, they close today. Can you put in an application? And I said, no, because I've agreed that we hadn't actually processed that with the community. We're just waiting for God to reveal to them what was right. Without trying to preempt anything. So I said, well, we'll pray about it with the community and I'll get back to you on Monday. And he said, okay. And I said, well, I'll ring the treasurer and tell him that there might be a late application on Monday. Well, when I got home and rang the treasurer, he said, it's all right, the bishop's already put in an application for you. It was a bishop's appointment when it was all said and done. So we ended up at Clarendon.
Yes.
With great joy.
Yeah.
Because it was so clearly what God was wanting.
And as God, I think I know the answer to this, but it's not always that clear, is it? I mean, that's the clearest I've ever heard any story, really.
No, and it's interesting. I think part of God's stretching of us is to cause us to exercise our faith muscles more and more as life goes on. You would think, the more you get to know God's voice, the clearer it becomes. And that's true in some sense. And I think if you need an answer and you need it now, and it's a case of life and death, then you can be sure that God's going to give it to you. But sometimes he says, you need to wrestle with this one. You need to work out the pros and cons. You need to work out what is the sacrifice you're making. Are you prepared to make it? Are you prepared to answer the call?
Absolutely.
Because for us at that time, I mean, we put the proceeds of the sale of our house into building a house at Beth Shalom, and because of the way it was set up, you can put money in, you can't take it out. So we left it all behind. So when we actually left Beth Shalom, we had our piano and our personal effects, and that was it. And that was it until recently.
And how old were you then when you took on Clarendon?
Probably around 30.
Yeah, yeah, which is really young.
Yes.
And like in my mind, you were old when we went to Clarendon. I've just realised lately, now that I'm 45, that you weren't old when we went to Clarendon. You were really young.
My beard was black.
Yeah.
I think that Dad makes life decisions differently from a lot of people. His story is about hearing God's voice and about sacrifice, because it does take sacrifice to follow God in the way that he did. But it's also about God's provision and generosity to him and to us, really, as a whole family. And yeah, again, if you want to hear more of that story, search for John on ruthamos.com.au. Okay, now we're going to finally, for today, talk to Ruth, not me, but another Ruth called Ruth Pinkerton. Now, Ruth has an amazing story. We met when she came to Tasmania and became the head of Scripture Union, which we call SU for short, here in Tasmania. But the journey to that position as head of SU took some really interesting twists and turns. And so as she tells her story today, I'm going to jump in with a few shortcuts on a few of the twists and turns of the story. And I hope that you don't mind. But if you want to hear the whole of the story, like all the amazing bits and pieces, it's there. It's up on the website under Ruth Pinkerton. So if you just search Ruth, you'll find it. And it's worth listening to. It's really incredible. Anyway, so here's her story of how she became the head of SU in Tasmania, and it started at school with a love of volcanoes.
I was a struggler at school, but I went to Iceland when I was 14, just after I'd become a Christian. A picture of me reading my Bible in Iceland when I was there. And I just fell in love with volcanoes. I just thought, wow, volcanoes, they are so amazing. I have got to go to university and find out more. And there's an extent to which I didn't know that there was an alternative to going to university. Like, my family would probably have been starting to suggest that maybe there were alternatives. But having come back and said, right, well, I will have to go to university and study volcanoes, they just said, oh, right, okay. And I gathered enough qualifications to do that, and off I went.
And so did you study volcanoes for a while after uni, or did you go straight
into...
I've
got an honours degree in geology, and which is what everybody does in the UK. Here honours seems to be the exception. Right, there, it's completely the norm.
So you're totally qualified to lick rocks now, is that right?
Well, indeed. Certainly get my nose on them, as many a lecturer shouted at us. Get your nose on those rocks. I don't think I licked any of them, to be honest, but there you go. So I did that. I had 4 years of doing that, and then I thought, okay, what am I going to do now? So I kind of looked around for a number of things. I was doing various kind of mission activities over summer, as I'd done each summer of university. And then it got to the end of summer, I thought, oh, blimey, I'm not going back to university, better get a job. I got offered 3 jobs in 1 week.
So after deciding to pass on the first 2 jobs, British Rail and a chalet girl in a skiing resort, I didn't even know that job existed, Ruth turned to the third job.
The third one was to go to a residential school in the south of England and look after intellectually disabled epileptic teenagers.
And how did that change your thinking about the future then?
Well, Well, there were two things I was, and I use this word hesitantly, two things I was never going to do when I was coming out of university. And I have pretty much stopped using the word never because it's a very dangerous word. I recommend people not to use it. One of the things I said I'd never do was work in a bank, which so far I have not done, and I have no ambition to do so. The other was that I would never be a teacher. And the reason that I didn't want to be a teacher was that I didn't think I had enough patience to be a teacher. Well,
fair.
Indeed. I worked with a group of young people who would have tried the patience of, well, a saint in the broadest sense of the word. And so it was this opportunity for God to say, you know, you could do this. And in actual fact, to recognise I knew all along I am a teacher.
So Ruth trained to become a teacher, and she first worked in a tiny school on an island off the west coast of Scotland. And from there, she went to London and she taught there for 4 years. While she was teaching, she was fully involved in her church. And then each summer, she'd travel off on what she calls a fabulous holidays. And eventually that hectic life left her feeling burnt out, and she stopped teaching and got a job at a summer camp in Canada.
And so I went over to this summer camp and I worked there and doing, well, actually what happened, I didn't really have any of the technical skills that they were after. Like they did swimming and hiking and teaching and archery. And so I'd done a little bit of archery. So they said, oh, right, okay, good, you can do the archery stuff. Well, it turned out that my teaching ability, I could transfer that to the young staff who knew how to do archery, and then they could teach archery much better. And this weekend, well, it was so obvious that you were
training the trainers.
Yes, that I was immediately asked if I could do that to other trainers doing other things as well. And I said, well, I think so. And so I then, I only had a group of kids for a fortnight, and then I got moved to Staff Hill and I was the trainer of the trainers. And oh, it's just, yeah, it was a bit crazy.
From there, through a chance meeting, Ruth went back to Scotland to work with a group called the Abernethy Trust.
And it was great. Loved it and became the senior instructor there. And again, worked, felt a lot of the impact of my work and who I was working with the staff that we had, young staff, and encouraging them and giving them confidence. So that was great. But then I damaged my knee really badly. Twice. No one go into the details, but basically after the second one I needed a reconstruction, which meant I had to keep off rough ground for a year. And so obviously being on rough ground was kind of my job.
Yes.
So I was immediately, it's interesting to reflect, this is kind of how I was with God in those days. I was immediately flared up cross with God about what was he playing at. Here I am serving.
What possibly good could come out of this?
Exactly. But then I kind of simmered down and I thought, well, at least a year is a reasonable amount of time. I could do something with a year. And so I thought, well, what's kind of missing from my CV, if you like? And I thought, well, I don't have any kind of business knowledge, or certainly not any academic study. So I actually was able to go to university and study for an MBA, a Master's in Business Administration.
Ruth finished her degree and realised she was ready for something new. But what? She went back to God.
Okay, Lord, here I am. You know, I've got a teaching qualification. I've worked with special needs kids. I've worked in the outdoors. I've recovered from a knee injury. I've got this MBA. How can I serve you?
But there was no answer for quite a while. Until something came up with Scripture Union Scotland.
I mean, SU was obviously really important to me. They were a part of my faith journey, and I value the organisation, and here's one of their senior staff telling me to apply for a job, and I've got nothing in the pipeline, and I've been praying for months for some opportunity.
Yep.
So, what's a girl to do? So I applied for the job, and they interviewed me, and they offered me the job. And with as much conviction as I believed God was present with me when I became a Christian, I believe God said, no, you're not to take that job.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I found myself phoning her up and saying, well, you know, thank you, really love SU, but actually I'm really sure this is not the job for me. So I think she usually gets the opposite of people phoning her up saying, why didn't I get the job? God told me I would get the job. Anyway, so she said, oh, well, that's very disappointing, but that's life. And then about, I don't know, 10 days later, 8-10 days later, her opposite number in the camping and holidays section of SU Scotland phoned me up. She said, I've got this other job. And this other job, they were looking for somebody who had a teaching qualification or background, ideally somebody who knew a bit about the outdoor industry in Scotland. If they'd worked with special needs, that would be excellent. If they could bring some kind of business and marketing knowledge to the thing, that would be really helpful. Pretty much had Ruth Pinkerton, please apply. And so it was like, oh, that's why I had to say no, because that job hadn't actually been quite formulated yet. And there it was. And yeah, that was absolutely the job for me.
Yeah, wow.
Mm-hmm. So I did that for 7 years. And then I was sort of headhunted in the SU sphere to the job that I came out to do in Tasmania. So yeah. That was a long time. That was a long story to get here. Anyway.
No, it's good though. And I think it's obvious to me, like if you tell somebody, you know, Ruth came from Scotland to serve as the head of SU down here in Tasmania, people would say, well, why Tasmania? But from your life story, it's like, well, that's, you know, you're just that kind of person. Yeah, let's try Tasmania.
Yeah. See what it's and like. And I was a contentedly single person as well, and so that made that decision so much easier. Mm. You know, if I was married, obviously my spouse would have had to have found a job here or got a visa, or, you know, it would just been so much more complicated. So it was, I mean, it wasn't a small decision, but it was definitely a good one.
Yeah. So if somebody's listening and they're sort of feeling like they're at the beginning of the journey, what sort of advice do you have for them?
Ooh. I can remember wishing, I sometimes still do, that maybe when you became a Christian, God should just put a nose ring through your nose so it could lead you more easily. But I would say that you just have to pay attention to who you are and who God is, you know. And actually there are a number of paths in life, I believe. I don't think, like, if you've done something that you then think, well, maybe I should have done something else, that's not disaster, that's not the end. There are a number of options. I could have stuck with the science option. I could have done a number of things. I'm thrilled with what I have decided to do and been able to do. But I think, yeah, if you are making decisions in good conscience with God, you can't really go wrong. And nice. He totally forgives you if you turn out not to have been in good conscience with him.
I hope these stories have been encouraging for you, and that whatever you're doing in this year, that you invite God to be there with you. Amazing things can happen when we let him take part in our adventures, as you have heard. I don't think we all have to be grand and awesome entrepreneurs or world changers, but I do think that we have our own part to play in this world. As Ruth says, God can take whatever we do and use it. So may this year for you be a year where you see his hand in whatever you're doing. Next episode, we'll be back to normal with more productivity tips and thoughts about living our own quiet lives. And I'm really looking forward to talking to Scotty after all this time. And I'll be chatting to you all again soon.